Welcome to the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm George Hammond, Chair of the Humanities Forum, which organized tonight's event. I'd like to welcome our audience here in San Francisco and our audiences online and on the radio. And tonight, it's my great pleasure to introduce Sarah Anzia, Assistant Professor at the Goldman School for Public Policy at UC Berkeley. Speaking about the politics of public pensions, we've all heard that this is a big future financial problem for lots of cities, states, and so on. What are the politics behind it? Sarah's going to let us know. Thanks a lot, Sarah.
So with all the attention being paid to the debt crisis in Europe, we actually have a big mess playing out right here in the United States. The massive underfunding of the retirement benefits that have been promised to public sector workers. The situation is bad. It's really bad, and it's bad in most states of the country. And this is a problem that has been building for decades. So I know we're in California, but let's start talking about Rhode Island. So this is an excerpt from an article published in the New York Times about a year and a half ago. I'll just read you a little bit. After decades of drift, denial, and inaction, Rhode Island's $14.8 billion pension system is in crisis. 10 cents of every state tax dollar now goes to retired public workers. Before long, that figure will climb perilously toward 20 cents. We're in the fight of our lives for the future of this state, said Gina Raimondo, who's the general treasurer of the state. And if the fight is lost, either the pension fund runs out of money or cities go bankrupt. And then the article continues, the nightmare scenario that Ms. Raimondo is that Ms. Raimondo has seen the future of America, and it is Rhode Island. Before this is over, many Americans may be forced to rethink what government means at the state and local level. Now, this probably isn't news for Californians who have read the news in the last few years. In 2010, a Stanford study projected that California's unfunded pension liability was in the neighborhood of $500 billion. In early 2011, the Little Hoover Commission came out with a report that concluded, among other things, that pension costs would crush government. And there have been a lot of efforts to fix the problem in the last few years to bring the problem under control, but at best, the results have been mixed. So San Jose and San Diego, their voters recently passed major pension reforms and intended to address the city's unfunded pension liabilities. And then, as you know, of course, last summer, the state enacted what was billed as a major pension reform. But there's been a widespread perception that the state's reform was more of a tweak than an overhaul, and that it really only addressed a small part of the problem. And even the San Jose reforms that were passed are tied up in legal challenges at the moment. So this type of thing is going on all over the country, not just California, not just Rhode Island. As you know, most government employees have what are called defined benefit plans. That means that they have traditional pensions. As an employee, like me, of a public university, when you retire, you earn a fixed amount of income based on your final salary, the years that you worked, and then a multiplier. And you get that payment for as long as you live. How does that work? Well, most state and local governments participate in a small number of state-sponsored plans, about 115 of them. And the government employees make regular contributions. Government employers make regular contributions. That money is pooled and invested, and that fund is used to pay retirement benefits. It sounds simple, but it gets complicated quickly because you need modeling to figure out how much you need in contributions today to pay benefits later, taking into account that money will be invested, and you don't know there's a lot of risk involved in those investments. You don't know how the returns will pan out. And yet, regardless of how well the funds do, the benefits have to be paid. At the end of the day, if there isn't enough money, somebody has to make up the difference. This is different, as I'm sure you're aware, than what's now common in the private sector, which are defined contribution plans. In a defined contribution plan, as an employee, you make regular contributions to a fund, usually supplemented by your employer, and then that goes into an account that you control. That money is invested in a way that you dictate, and the money then that's in that fund is used to pay your retirement benefits. But if there isn't enough money when you retire, that's your problem. There's no defined benefit. And With the defined benefit plan, it's very different. Again, if the investments don't perform, somebody has to make up the difference. Those benefits will be paid. And so they have to be made up by increased contributions by the employees, by the governments, or some combination. So that's the big problem today. There isn't enough money. We haven't set aside enough money in state pension funds to pay the benefits that have already been promised and earned by public sector workers. And those benefits are legally guaranteed. They will be paid. In total, state and local governments' public pension liabilities are underfunded by, somewhere between $750 billion and $4 trillion. Whoa, that's a big range, right? It depends on whose estimates you use. But the problem is, basically, for decades, government officials have promised increasingly generous benefits to public sector workers and have consistently failed to set aside enough money to pay for them. And so now, in order to ensure that there's enough money, the governments, the participating governments and their employees, specifically the governments, are being asked to shell out greater and greater sums of money. And in many cases, in many states and cities, these contributions are in double-digit percentages of their operating budgets. So these are cutting out other services like police and fire and teachers. So these are figures from the Pew Center on the States. This just is a summary of how bad the problem is. It's the percentage of total sector pension liabilities in each state that are funded. So we can see in Illinois, the low is 45%. There are a couple states at 100%, like Wisconsin. This is as of fiscal year 2010. Okay, but there's a lot of uncertainty about how much we've actually promised, how much we actually owe to public sector workers. And why is that? Well, most financial experts agree that the numbers that governments themselves provide, which are the numbers that the Pew Center and the states uses, are far too generous, actually. Meaning that the numbers up here, 45% funded in Illinois, 78% in California, these are far too generous, that actually the problem is much worse than this map would actually show. And most of the variation in the estimates have to do with technical details, like the discount rate used. Okay, you've probably heard a lot about this. And some of the lead revisionist work that's been done on estimating public pension liabilities has been done by Robert Novy Marks and Joshua Raw. And here's a map that shows some of their numbers. And these are color-coded, so you don't have to see the numbers. So what this means, the states that are dark have the biggest unfunded pension liabilities per capita. So these are dollar values representing the amount of unfunded public pension liabilities in each state per capita, meaning per state resident. So that means in a state like California, there are unfunded liabilities, unfunded public sector pension liabilities, equivalent to over $10,000 per person in the state. In states like Ohio and New Jersey, it's $14,000. Okay? This is a big, big shortfall. So the goal of the research I'm going to talk about today is not how big is the problem. There's a whole cottage industry trying to figure out how big the problem is. But how did we get here? This is work that's joint with Terry Moe at Stanford. How did we get here? How did this happen? Seems like a big mess, and the model seems simple. And I'll just cut to the chase in some sense. It's to simply say that this is a problem caused by faulty accounting assumptions or a problem caused by the Great Recession. This is a huge part of the picture. It misses the politics. Think about it. Every quantity here that matters, the level of benefits, the level of contributions, the cost of living adjustments, even assumptions used to estimate liabilities, these are within the authority of state governments, state legislatures, and governors. Okay? And presumably the decisions then are political decisions. They're shaped by the political processes that generate those decisions and the interest groups and constituencies that influence them. So pensions, the pension problem has its origins in politics. And I'll tell you right off the bat, the impression you get from listening to or reading the news these days is misleading. What do I mean? Well, it's natural to think that, okay, when it comes to the problem of public pensions, it must be the Democrats' fault, right? Democrats are the party of labor. Public sector unions are their core supporters. And so if part of the problem of pension benefits of government workers is that the benefits have been increased to unsustainable levels, it must be that the Democrats are responding to their constituents and increasing benefits. Okay, well, that makes sense. And probably Republicans resisted all of this. Republicans aren't sympathetic to public sector unions. They've been on the attack in Wisconsin and Ohio. Besides, public sector pensions are about spending, about public spending, and we know that Democrats are more in favor of public spending and Republicans like spending cuts. Okay, but that misses a big, big part of the picture. Okay, but let's just take, I want to make it clear how widespread this perception is, that the Democrats are the problem, Republicans are the ones who've been resisting all this. This is an excerpt from an editorial in the Wall Street Journal from last year, and I won't read the whole thing, but if we see at the top it says, the Democrats who are running Illinois into the ground can't bring themselves to oppose union demands. It talks about the size of the problem, and then at the end it says, for decades, Democrats have bought union support in elections by using surplus revenue during good times to pad pension and retiree health care benefits. All right. Well, we think this is off target in important respects. And why? To see why, you have to think about three political basics: voters, interest groups, and the perverse logic of public sector pensions. Let's start with voters. We like to think of elected officials as being responsive to voters in some way, so we'll start there. But until the Great Recession, there's absolutely no evidence that public pensions were on the minds of voters at all. Pensions weren't in the headlines. There were no public opinion polls on pensions. And if any enterprising voter tried to figure out for him or herself what was going on with public pensions, he or she would have found that everything about pensions is complicated. It's really hard to understand. So politicians of both parties faced voters who didn't know much and didn't care about public pensions. All right, well, there are some voters who care. The beneficiaries, the people whose pensions we're talking about, they know about public pensions. They know that decisions are made by governments that affect their retirement benefits. They care. They know. And so what we're looking at here for under the normal politics of pensions, politicians faced voters who didn't know much, but then there were these people who cared a lot and who clearly were ready to reward politicians for taking actions that were favorable on public pensions, favorable to them. All right, so both parties had incentives to say yes. For Republicans, there was no voter demand that they oppose pension increases, and there was potential gain from being responsive to public sector workers. Well, what about interest groups? During these normal times, meaning the years prior to the Great Recession, the interest group system was unbalanced. Public sector workers are represented by public sector unions in many states, and public sector unions are some of the most influential and active interest groups in the country. Naturally, they have strong incentives to pressure politicians to take favorable actions on pensions. Well, okay, what interest groups are on the other side?
Howard Jarvis.
Okay. There are no interest groups that are systematically on the other side pushing for cutbacks or against increases in public sector pensions. So under the normal politics of pensions, there was nothing of salience to stimulate this organized opposition. So the interest group system was one-sided. And it would make sense that Democrats would take the lead in pushing for generous pensions for public sector workers, but why would we expect Republicans to oppose them? They had nothing to gain by doing so. There were no interest groups to reward them for saying no. Surely they had something to lose by upsetting public sector unions who could put up a challenger or get involved in their next election. So even Republicans had incentives to support more valuable pensions. What this suggests is that during the normal times that went on for decades, Republicans had incentives to go along with Democrats. We think that actually what we should expect is that the politics of public sector pensions for a long time was bipartisan. But that's not all. Okay, recall that defined benefit plans are financed by ongoing contributions from employees and employers, that money's invested, and in theory, the fund should be sufficient to pay for the benefits that retirees have been promised. So it's up to governments to make the contributions that are necessary each year to make sure that there's enough to pay the benefits. But that's the catch. The politicians don't have incentives to do that. Politicians can basically promise workers better benefits today, and those higher benefits don't have to be paid for many years in the future. In theory, as soon as they promise better benefits, they should increase contributions to fund those better benefits, right? Well, if they don't, not much happens, at least for a while. Eventually, it will be a problem. Eventually, there won't be enough money to pay the benefits that have promised. But by the time eventually arrives, the politicians who promised to increase benefits and scored the political points for promising those benefits are out of office. They're gone. Someone else is in office. And the bill becomes someone else's problem. Other politicians, other taxpayers. Okay, so you might think, what we want to argue is that this is not a partisan phenomenon. This is universal. But you might say, okay, Democrats would actually be less likely to underfund pensions since they'd want to ensure the solvency of the funds that will pay for public sector workers' retirement benefits. These are their constituents. Maybe, but maybe not. The future benefits being promised to public sector workers are legally guaranteed. They will be paid. It will just be someone else's problem in the future to find the money to pay for them. In the meantime, Democrats and union leaders have incentives to lock in high benefit levels and maybe even to keep contributions low because that frees up money for something else. And Republicans have incentives to go along with this. All right, there's one other thing I want to emphasize. All right, keeping contributions low is much easier under the rosy actuarial assumptions that financial economists have been railing against in the last few years, discount rates. By systematically understating future liabilities, these assumptions call for contributions that are much lower than what economists say are required for full funding. And that gives politicians technical justification for keeping contributions low. So keeping everyone's costs down. The traditional assumptions that we've been hearing a lot about actually work really well for politicians, and they have incentives to keep them that way. Now, of course, you're thinking a lot of things changed with the Great Recession. Pensions were so underfunded that they required huge immediate contributions. Ordinary voters were flooded with information about pensions. Meanwhile, conservative interest groups like the Tea Party suddenly got active on pensions, as did many good government groups. And so suddenly on pensions, public sector unions had some opposition. And for the first time, Republicans had reason to push back against benefit expansion and support retrenchment. Now, Democrats still had reason to be pro-pension, but in this new environment, being pro-pension meant something different. It meant defending past gains, preventing reform from going too far, moderating increases in employee contributions, and keeping things as tightly sealed up as they could. So suddenly, with the Great Recession, there was a recipe for the partisan politics that now we're familiar with. But we shouldn't make judgments about the origins of the problem based on today's rhetoric. We actually think that until recently, Republicans and Democrats were both responsible. All right, so all of these things are testable in some sense. As I said earlier, the major decisions about public pensions are made by state governments, state legislatures and governors. So we collected some data. We used a database of legislation passed by state legislatures that was put together by the National Conference of State Legislatures. They found every bill passed by state governments between 1999 and 2011 that affected public pensions in some way. And we coded each of these bills on a few key dimensions that we thought were really important for to the fiscal solvency of these funds. The first one is, did the bill increase or decrease benefits of public sector workers, the retirement benefits of public sector workers? All right, so here's an example, which is probably too small for you to read, so I'll read it to you. Illinois increased the retirement benefits formula for alternative plan members, that's public safety workers, to a flat rate of 2.5% for each year for those who do get Social Security and 3% for those who don't get Social Security. And it increased the maximum allowable pension from 75 to 80%. So most people's pensions are based on a multiplier. So your years of service times a multiplier. That's what this is changing. This is a very clear increase in the pension benefits of public sector workers in the state. But we also coded a few other things as increases in benefits, things that increase increase the amount of salary that your pension could be based on. There are other ways of increasing benefits other than this example. The second dimension we coded is probably a little bit less clear, unless you've kind of waded through the specifics of public pensions in California or some other state. But a lot of states, the state legislatures can enact changes that expand the range of options available to employees when it comes to collecting their pensions. So, like in many, so airlines, you can purchase miles that you didn't actually fly. Well, with public pensions, many states allow you to purchase years of credit for years of service you didn't actually work. Okay, and that increases your pension payout. So that's bills that allowed this sort of thing for the first time expanded employees' options, and these are usually ways in which public employees can increase their pension payouts. Also, they might allow you to take a pension rather than payments in perpetuity, a lump sum payment. All of these things expand options. So here's an example from Washington. Those who qualify can purchase as much as 5 years additional service credit effective July 2006. All right, then we coded bills according to whether they increased or decreased employer contributions. All right, so what does this mean? Well, here's an example from New Jersey. The legislature reduced the normal contributions scheduled to be made by governments to the police and firemen's retirement system in April of 2001 by $150 million. It was supposed to be about $225 million. Why are they doing this? Very favorable investment returns on pension assets in recent years from generated sufficient excess assets to eliminate normal contributions for those employers in 2002. What does that mean? The fund's full of money. We don't need to make our contributions. The fund has tons of money. And what are they going to do with the money that they would otherwise contribute to the pension fund? They're going to use it for tax relief. Savings realized by counties and municipalities as a result of the reduction will be used for property tax relief. Okay, so they don't have to make their contributions. What will they do that with that money? They're going to use it for tax relief. All right, let's just stop for a second. This is totally irresponsible. This happened all over the place. The whole point of having good years is to buffer the bad years. Okay. So, we coded bills according to whether they decreased or increased employers' contributions. And then, employee contributions. So, did a bill change the amount that employees had to contribute? All right, here's an example from Wisconsin 2011, that I'm sure you're all familiar with. Okay, the bill requires that members of the Milwaukee County and City Employees Retirement Systems pay all of the employee-required contribution. It prohibits local governments from establishing pensions unless it requires employees to pay half of actuarially required contributions, and it prohibits a local government unit from paying on behalf of the employee the employee's share. Okay, this is a really nice example because it illustrates an important feature of the rules for employee contributions. In most states, there are rules for how much employers have to put in, how much employees have to put in, but then locally, through the collective bargaining process, a lot of times local governments or state governments will agree to pay the employer's share. Yes?
In many cases, it seems that governments ask unions to accept lower salaries in exchange for...
We'll come back to that. Yeah, that's a good point. Okay, so this is called, what I just described is called employer pickup. So the employer picks up the contributions of the employees. That's what Governor Walker did, and this is coded as an increase in employee contributions. All right, so these are the four dimensions we coded the bills on. We have 442 of them that made changes on one of these dimensions. So let's look at what the states have been doing. Okay. These are changes to benefit levels. Any bill that changed benefit levels is represented in this graph. Each bar represents the number of bills passed across the country in each year. You have the years along the horizontal axis. The green bars are increases. The orange bars are decreases. Okay, what we see here is that in 1999, 2000, 2001, states are increasing benefits, increases. And there are about, I think there are 33 states in this 3 years that increased benefits for their public sector workers. And that continued all the way up through 2009, and then bam. Everyone started to backpedal and try to decrease, they tried to pass bills that decreased benefits. But this, so clearly there's a trend here. You know, up until the recession, Everyone's marching along increasing benefits, and then they try to reverse course. But this graph actually misses something, which is that we couldn't code the magnitude of the changes that were made. We couldn't say, oh, this bill had a huge impact on liabilities, and this one had a small one. And these increases, for the most part, if you read through the changes, they made changes for the benefits of all employees, sometimes even retroactively. So, and when you make changes like that, they're permanent. You can't go back and then take away someone's pension benefits. Even for current employees who haven't, for years they haven't worked yet, you can't decrease their benefits. Whereas these decreases in the later years usually only affected new hires, people who haven't yet been hired by the government. So these increases are far more costly than these decreases are cost saving. Okay, so we should expect to see the same thing for employee options. And that's basically what we see. So the green bars are increases in the options, like purchasing, can you purchase credit for years that you didn't actually work? So throughout the decade, expansions in options, and then a couple years, 2010, 2011, you see some efforts to rein in the options available, but even there, only five bills. All right, what about employee contributions? Let's talk about increases in employee contributions. These are obviously changes that are bad for public sector workers. I have to pay a certain percentage toward my pension, and I would rather not pay anything. So very early, the green bars represent increases in employees' contributions. So very early, you see little green bars, and then a spike after the recession. States are all trying to get employees to contribute more. So that matches the pattern that I showed you in the previous graphs. But what about employee decreases in employee contributions, the orange bars? Well, we don't see very much in our data. And so you might think, well, that's funny, because these early years were years of generosity to public sector workers. Why don't we see decreases in employee contributions? Well, a couple reasons, actually, and it's not all that puzzling if you think about it. Because I just got through explaining that through employer pickup and practices of that sort, at the local level, governments agree to pick up employees' contributions. So most of the decreases in employee contributions, we think, are happening at the local level, not at the state level, and our data are all state government decisions. So we're probably, even if there was a trend of decreasing employee contributions in this early period, we're missing it. But it's also remarkable, even if this described all of the activity, which it doesn't, it's quite remarkable that for all of the increases in benefits in the early period, there were very few corresponding increases in employee contributions, right? So they're increasing benefits, but they're not asking employees to pay more toward their own pensions. All right, what about changes to employer contributions? This graph looks a little bit different, and for a reason. What we see here is that there's the trend in the early period is to decrease employer contributions, and then again, the trend is a lot of orange bars in the later period. Well, that looks different. The reason is that you can decrease employer contributions for a few different reasons. The motivation is different. In this early period, the funds are flush. There's lots of money. And they say, just like the New Jersey example, okay, we can take a break, take a pension holiday. And that's what these decreases in employer contributions are. This later period, something different is going on. In this later period, the state and local governments are really crunched. And their required pension payments have ballooned. And so they're being asked to shell out lots of money. And so what state governments are doing here in reducing contributions is giving them some relief from what their payments otherwise would be to the pensions. That illustrates something important about our data, which is that we're not talking about absolute decreases, we're talking about changes from what their payments would otherwise be. Very different. So throughout this period, governments required pension payments were going up and up and up, but these represent decreases from what they would otherwise be. All right. Now, okay, this is eye-opening. It shows that basically in the early to mid-2000s, these were years of generosity to government employees' pensions. Benefit increases, options increases, only rare increases in employees' contributions, and maybe decreases we're not seeing. And then after the recession, state governments started decreasing benefits, trimming options, and requiring employees to contribute more. So after the Great Recession, it was a new era for pension policy. And the next thing we want to do is test whether it was a new era for pension politics, too. So we figured, all right, let's find out who voted for these things. These are decisions being made by state legislatures. We can track their votes. So we collected data on individual state legislators' votes on all of the pension bills that we could. And we found, got these individual level vote data for 314 of the bills in our data set. And this amounts to over 40,000 votes that we've tracked. And we have their party identification of the legislature. What we want to know, okay, is it the conventional view that the Democrats have been voting in favor of things like benefit increases and employee contribution decreases while Republicans have been pushing back? Or is our more nuanced story a better explanation that the politics of pensions was bipartisan, everyone voting yes until the Great Recession, and then only after 2008 did it become partisan? So using these data on legislators' votes, we calculate two measures of what we think represents partisanship. So we took all of the votes for each bill. We said, what percentage of Democrats voted yes, which percentage of Republicans voted yes. And the first measure is we just took the difference. So this is a measure of how split the parties were on a pension bill vote. And then we said, okay, for this given bill, did we see a majority of Republicans voting against a majority of Democrats? That's also a measure of how partisan the bill was. So what I'm going to do is plot the averages of these two measures over time. Okay. What do we see here? This dotted line is the average of the difference between the percentage of the parties voting yes. Okay? What we see is that up until 2008, the parties are pretty much voting together. All right? About 13% on average difference between, 13 percentage points difference between the parties. And then all of a sudden, boom. In 2009, the parties split, and they start voting on opposite sides of pension bills. This is a shock. I mean, it's really stunning that you see the sudden spike in 2009, and then it holds for 2010 and 2011. What about if we look at the percentage of votes in each year in which a majority of Republicans voted against a majority of Democrats? Same thing. 4 to 14% of all pension bills in the early years, and then all of a sudden you see 40% of the bills split the parties. So this is supportive of what we're saying, that actually Democrats and Republicans were voting together on pensions for a long time up until this recession. But, and so this is the bottom line, is that the normal politics of pension is bipartisan. But of course this graph only looks at differences between the parties, and we have a theory about the overtime patterns in Republican and Democrat votes. So let's take bills that increase benefits. We expect that prior to the recession, Democrats and Republicans both had strong reasons to vote yes on increasing benefits and little reason to vote no. And then after the recession, Democrats should still favor benefit increases, and Republicans should start to have a reason to say no. So let's look. Okay. Here, the blue are the Democrats, the red are the Republicans. This is the percentage of members within each party who are voting yes on increases in pension benefits. And these are the early years, 1999 to 2008. These two are 2009 to 2011. Okay, what do we see? Who's voting in favor of increasing pension benefits? Everyone in the early period. Republicans and Democrats, both high 90%. And then, since the recession, you still see Democrats supporting increases in pension benefits. Republicans start to say no. Now, there's still a lot of Republicans are still voting yes on increases in pension benefits, but you see this sudden drop. And what we think happened is that interest groups started opposing public sector unions for the first time, and voters started to become aware of what had been going on for the last they became aware of how bad the problem was. We see the same thing in voting on options increases. When it comes to voting for things like letting employees purchase credit for years they didn't work, everybody's voting for it, Republicans and Democrats, in the early years. And then suddenly, you see Republicans start to say, oh, no, we're not for that. All right. Now, we can't do this for employee contribution increases or employee contribution decreases, because I just got finished saying we don't have enough data. But what about pension reform? We're going to wait till the end to do questions so we can pass around the microphone. What about pension reform or pension retrenchment? Benefit, things like benefit decreases, requirements that employees pay more toward their pensions. Well, the first thing to note is there actually weren't many of those bills prior to 2009, and any bills that did pass probably didn't divide the parties very much. But what about after the Great Recession? We'd expect Republicans to favor cutbacks to benefits and increases, and actually favor increases in employee contributions, and we expect Democrats to oppose those things. But for things like benefit decreases and employee contribution increases, there's a problem with just looking at how legislators voted. Let's take California as an example. So Governor Brown, as you know, proposed a 12-point plan that would have required employees to pay half the annual cost of their pensions, a hybrid for new employees, a hybrid direct benefit and, I'm sorry, a defined benefit and defined contribution plan for new employees, and increased retirement ages for new employees, and then among other things. And the bill, when he proposed this 12-point plan, Republicans immediately endorsed it, right out of the gate. They almost all endorsed it. And Democrats sat on it for a long time. It was clear that they didn't like this. They weren't going to let this 12-point plan go through. Okay, Democrats in the legislature. But eventually, the Democrats did push through a bill, and it was a weaker form of the 12-point plan. Well, why did they push through a bill at all? Well, they had to. In this climate, something had to be done. If they didn't do anything, it was going to be politically disastrous. They had to do something. So it became the Democrats' job to do make a change that would only make small changes, you know, not actually make drastic changes that weren't going to be to the advantage of public sector workers who are their constituents. So what do? They pass through a weaker bill, and in the end, almost all Democrats voted for it. This shows almost all Democrats voted in favor of AB 340. Republicans actually mostly didn't vote. And the ones that did, the majority of them voted against it. Okay, well, why did Republicans vote against it? It's not because they didn't want reform. It's because they didn't think it went far enough. Here's a quote from a state senator. Each of us know in our hearts this is a small, small, small step. So if we just looked at the votes and said, okay, well, what's going on here? We would say Democrats wanted reform. They wanted benefit decreases and employee contribution increases, and Republicans didn't. But that's wrong, because we know that Republicans wanted reform. They just didn't think this bill went far enough. So we have this is a problem in interpreting legislators' positions based on the votes that we see. So for the next two graphs I'm going to show you, what we do is we drop the bills. We exclude the bills that we think are most likely to have this kind of reversal, Republicans voting against a bill because they don't think it goes far enough. So we drop bills that were major reform bills that were passed in state legislatures or state governments. So as a strategy, this makes sense because we couldn't imagine any Republican-controlled state governments that would push through a bill that Republicans didn't think went far enough, that they would vote against because they didn't think it would go far enough in reforming pensions. All right, so let's look at bills that increase employee contributions. This is something that public sector workers should not favor. And what we see here is that prior to the recession, Democrats and Republicans weren't split on the issue, but then after the recession on benefits, these are employee contribution increases, Democrats started to say no, at least to some extent, and Republicans were more likely to vote yes on employee contribution increases. And in a more muted way, you would see the same thing for bills that decrease benefits, that Democrats became, you saw the party split, Democrats were less in favor of decreasing benefits than Republicans. All right, so the big takeaway here is that you shouldn't be fooled by the last couple of years. Okay, yeah, the last few years have been more of what we'd expect, partisanship. We're used to that now, right? Polarized political parties. But that doesn't tell us how we got here. It doesn't tell us how we got into this mess. And it may not tell us where we're going in the future. Prior to the Great Recession, the state legislators, regardless of party, were all voting for the types of things that got the states in trouble. Benefit increases, options expansion, and no corresponding increases in contributions. But I haven't talked about the partisan breakdown yet in changes to employers' contributions. It's important to keep in mind that, as I said, politicians might want to decrease government's contributions for a few different reasons. There are pension holidays in the good time, giving state governments and local governments relief in bad times. But in both scenarios, they presumably want the money for something else. The reason that I'm going to put a graph up here, but it's not clear what we should expect of the political parties on decreases to employer contributions. Let me just break this down for a minute. Okay, take pension holidays. When the funds are full of money, who are Democrats or Republicans more likely to say decrease government's contributions? Well, okay, you might think the party of fiscal conservatism, the Republicans, might be more likely to insist that government employers make their required contributions, no matter what. But Republicans might also look favorably on pension holidays. Because in the short run, which is all politicians' time frame, they keep costs down, they free up money for other things like tax relief, and there are political rewards for doing stuff like that. They can claim credit. So let's take Chris Christie, right? Chris Christie, a governor known for pension cutbacks. He's been under fire from the governor of Connecticut over his dodging of the pension bill. Okay, so when Christie pushed through the pension changes that required public workers for the first time to contribute toward their retirement and raise the retirement age, the national media saluted the ability of a tough Republican governor to rein in out-of-control government unions. Left out of that narrative was Christie's decision not to put any state money toward pensions in his first year in office, which makes it easier to balance the budget, but causes long-term fiscal problems. And the 2011 law that required workers to kick in and retire later also allowed the state to wait another 7 years to contribute the amount necessary to properly fund the pension plan. Okay. Well, what about Democrats? So do you think Democrats would be the ones that would be more likely to be responsible? They've certainly voted to contribute to higher benefits, more options, and lower employee contributions, but maybe they want to make sure that governments have sufficient contributions set away so to ensure the solvency of the retirement benefits of public sector employees. But they might also see appeal in taking a break from contributions because it frees up money for other things, other constituencies. And because, just like Republicans, their local governments will be politically grateful. So what do you think? Well, this shows who voted yes on decreasing government's contributions. All right, it doesn't look like Democrats were the more responsible one, but everybody's voting, right? For the most part, large majorities of both parties in both time periods are voting for decreasing employer contributions. There is a gap, Republicans slightly less likely to, but everybody's doing it. Okay, so what do we conclude from all this? As you may have noticed, even though Republican support for benefit increases and option increases have decreased, there are still a lot of Republicans voting for these things. So even with all the new attention from voters and the pressure from conservative groups and good government groups to fix the problem, and given the perverse logic of pensions that you can promise benefits now and defer payment until later when someone else is in office, there's really only so much you can do within the existing structure to get politicians to actually manage this well. And given the importance of public sector unions to the public sector, to the Democratic Party, I think Democrats will probably continue to take steps to protect the interests of government employees. And Republicans will probably, to some extent, continue to push back, but only to an extent, I think. And the question is, are they going to continue to fight with the same intensity a year, 3 years, 5 years, 10 years in the future? Well, probably not. So this is the question. Pensions are going to continue to be a complicated issue and hard for voters to understand. At some point, the economy will improve, at some point, and people won't pay close attention anymore. The Tea Party, sure, it's actually outlived my expectations. It's proven itself to be a force of conservatism in the country. But let's face it, the Tea Party is going to get active on a whole host of issues, healthcare. And you might think that at some point they're going to take the foot off the gas on pension issues. But public sector workers will still care about pensions. These are their retirement benefits. They're still going to be there. This is an important issue for them. And so what we have to worry about now is that we've had this wave of reform, and maybe the issue is going to die down, and we'll go back to what I've just described as the normal politics of pensions. That's just my speculation, so I can't say. What we can say definitively, though, is that in terms of politics and partisanship, the last few years have been an aberration. The normal politics of pensions is actually bipartisan. So who is responsible for creating the modern fiscal crisis in public sector pensions? What we conclude is they all were.
Thank you very much, Sarah, for a great talk on the background of politics in public pensions. And I'd like to remind our radio and online audiences that they're listening to Sarah Anzius speaking about the politics of public pensions at the Commonwealth Club of California. Now it's time for questions.
I don't disagree with anything that you said. And if you had somebody from a labor union standing up there, I think they would say a couple things. They would probably say that the average pension that public sector employees get, like in the state, is about $25,000 or $28,000. Yeah, you have executives that make, you know, $120,000 or more, but those are the small outliers. The other thing that they would probably say is that employees make less money in salary in the public sector than the private sector, and that probably some of the increases in pensions that you described were because the government elected officials didn't want to increase salaries, so the unions negotiated and said, well, we'll keep our salaries flat if you increase our health care benefits and increase our pensions. And I am, in full disclosure, for 5 years I worked for the state. Previously I worked for the private sector, and I make a lot less money in salary now. And I only have 5 years, so my pension would be really small. It's a secure job. I like my work. But, you know, the other side does have other points, which is not beyond the scope of what you were talking about, but I thought it's important.
Okay. There are a few points in there. I'll respond quickly. The first is the average pension figures. I'm always skeptical of people who cite average pension figures, just as I'm skeptical of the most egregious cases that make the news. But when people say the average pension, well, that doesn't mean very much because that includes people who only work for government for 10 years. And so they're going to have smaller pensions and people, you know, part-time workers. So you have to be careful about which numbers you use in order to quantify, what the typical person who has worked every year for government is actually earning in pensions. The second thing that this is I agree, this is a very convenient, increasing benefits is a convenient way for politicians to, what I've just said, compensate public sector workers more without doing it in a way that will become, where the bill will come due right away next year and be right in there in the operating budget. You know, that's exactly our point, that this is politically, they just can't resist, right? And pensions, even more so than health benefits. And then the question about whether these increased benefits make up for lower salaries. Okay, so there's a lot of debate about this. It has been shown that in the public sector, for the same level of education and experience, salaries are slightly lower in the public sector than in the private sector. The question is, the debate going on right now is whether the benefits make up for that difference, are still short, or actually make it so that public sector employees are more compensated or better compensated than private sector employees. That's a debate that is still going on.
Hi. First of all, I'd like to thank you for your eloquent argument in favor of Proposition 32. But I'm wondering about the political analysis there. Did you do any work on who sponsored the bills?
Mm-hmm.
Because I can kind of see a situation where one side sponsors the bills and pushes hard, and the other side says, you know, this thing's probably going to pass anyway, so why should I antagonize a powerful special interest group? So I'll just vote yes anyway.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering whether that factored in. Just one more comment about the relative salaries. You know, the proof is in the pudding. Turnover in the public sector is about a tenth of what it is in the private sector. So when you adjust for stress and productivity and benefits and all that, there's some argument, you know, the market is arguing that public employees are paid quite adequately because they never leave their jobs.
Yeah. I mean, that's the big debate. And then there are questions about should you factor in the enhanced job security in the public sector? Does that count as compensation? And so there's a lot of disagreement about that. But As far as who sponsored the bill, no, we haven't done that yet, but we could. I would think, so what we would argue is that really if they're voting for it, you know, we can still attribute responsibility to people who are voting yes, that no one was standing up and saying, okay, if we're going to increase benefits, well, first of all, these benefits might be unsustainable, but if we're going to do this, we should include an increase in contributions with it. You know, that should be paired with it. So we could look at the sponsorship, but I think it does tell us something by looking at who voted yes.
This is a two-part question, and the first question is a rhetorical question. I do not expect an answer.
Okay. Thanks. Thanks for telling me.
The rhetorical question is do you believe in the tooth fairy? Is it a valid assumption? Now, you're speaking as a political scientist rather than an economist, and I suspect that most of the economists would say there is no guarantee that the good times will return. And with the amount of indebtedness that the city of San Francisco, the state of California, the state of Illinois, et cetera, have now accumulated, it's a big boulder to push aside. And I'm disappointed that you said nothing about bankruptcy and you've said nothing about Stockton, California. Mm-hmm. Would you comment about Stockton,
sure.
California?
Sure. Well, I think Stockton, what happens with Stockton will be eye-opening. Because with Vallejo, I think critics, the people who've really been paying attention to pensions, were looking to Vallejo as maybe a case that would show that these contracts between employers and employees, pension obligations, could be undone. But for the most part, in Vallejo, pensions were left intact, and those pensions are being paid. Now, so Stockton, can those obligations be changed? That is really the open question, and I don't know. I'm not a legal expert. I can't tell you what's going to happen with Stockton, but I can say that everybody is looking at Stockton to see whether what has been promised to the employees is going to be honored, and if bankruptcy is going to become a way of getting out of this big problem, and in a way that would, you know, obviously be detrimental, like in Pritchard, Alabama, be detrimental to the employees who've been counting on this for their retirement. So I don't know what's going to happen with Stockton, but I can say that it's people are very interested in seeing what happens.
Yeah, I'd like to sort of follow up on that question. I think your presentation had this presumption of these benefits are going to be paid. You kept yeah. saying that as a maxim, and I don't accept it at all. Mm-hmm. I mean, personally, I grew up in Florida where it was illegal to spike pensions. I would far, far rather see California threaten to go bankrupt and force a retroactive renegotiation of what I consider to be egregious benefit over negotiation than preserve them. Mm-hmm. So I actually do take an issue because you seem to hammer that like three times that you think these are just absolutely have to be paid. Well, at some point they won't. At some point the state won't be able to extend any more credit. Various states won't be able to get any more credit, and they simply won't be paid because no one will be able to pay the bill.
Yeah. Okay. So when I say they will be paid, I'm trying to illustrate what the thinking of the players might be, that why would Democrats want to underfund pensions? Why wouldn't unions be monitoring the funding of pensions? Well, because it doesn't matter. These are contracts. They're legally protected. So they're thinking, well, that's the government's problem, maybe. I don't know this for sure. I'm speculating. But there's a reason to think that even unions whose members, these benefits, whose benefits we're talking about, don't really have incentives to follow up on how much money's going into the fund and who's not putting in. So the question you're asking is exactly the right one. I don't know. I don't know what's going to happen. I don't know what's going to happen in the legal debates that are going on. But you have people saying that these are legally binding obligations that cannot be broken. And then there are people saying these cannot be met. So I don't have a crystal ball. I can't say what's going to happen. This is going to be hashed out in the courts.
One of the issues that I've seen also is the big battle between pension holders and municipal bondholders, and the big argument being who has seniority over what debt has to be repaid. I'm curious because what seems to be happening now as a lot of entities, public entities, go into fiscal crisis, they're starting to see more and more the option of bankruptcy as a way out. And although Stockton has yet to be resolved, it seems that though that could be potentially another option that up until now wasn't on the table.
Right.
I'm curious if you think that's also something that's a partisan, plays in the partisan world at all or not, or
well, what? Okay. So let's just, I think bankruptcy as a solution is a really painful one. And to say, well, we're just going to see a lot of cities go bankrupt in counties, and that may be true, but it's a very long, painful, expensive, drawn-out process. And I don't think the decision to go into bankruptcy was one that will be taken lightly. But should we expect to see partisanship? Possibly. Quite possibly. Because the worry is that, just as you say, that maybe there's some risk to these benefits. And if that's a risk, which it's not clear it is, if that's a risk, then Democrats should worry about introducing this uncertainty. As soon as you get the courts involved, there's a risk that a decision won't be favorable to unions. And so then we should expect Democrats to really stand up for these important constituencies. Absolutely.
There's another issue that, that hasn't been raised. I think it very complicated all those different issues. But when you talk about the nonpartisanship between the Republicans and the Democrats, one thing is that the big pile of money is a big pile of capital. And a lot of Silicon Valley startups, CalPERS was one of the first investors in hedge funds in order to increase their returns because they were of their shortfalls. And millions and billions of dollars are there available, and there have been plenty of scandals where, you know, and that's all been a pile of money, and that's a sort of Republican constituency, you might mm-hmm. say, that wants the money to be piled up and used.
Right, right.
So it's kind of hard to track, mm-hmm. but it's another element.
Yeah, a couple of months ago, I had occasion to talk to a professor at Stanford about this issue, and he raised an interesting point, which was when you look at the existing pension holders and you're saying that you can't go back on what they've already been promised, he did raise the point, what you can do, however, is simply say, we will essentially freeze your compensation level where it is right now going forward. Or you could go to the adjusted pension plan, which also has salary increases, and essentially give people that choice. And that way, people who are close to retirement, they might just simply say, I'll stay with the old pension plan, mm-hmm. whereas people at an earlier stage might decide to say, let me go to the new pension plan, but with also the more generous salary plan. And he also said, ultimately, what you really need to go to is a defined contribution plan, because ultimately what's really going on is you have states that are not allowed to run deficits for operating expense, and they're basically doing that through the back door by doing it through worker benefit programs, through pensions and health insurance. And the way to get around that ultimately would be to simply say is, whatever obligations we have for what you did working this given year are all paid out in the same year. And then you can have a public annuity firm, managing that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. No, I think but all of these have to be decided in the political process, and you better bet that there are going to be people fighting very hard to not let a defined contribution plan be introduced or a tiered system.
Ironically, all the benefits other than salary that got started, it was because of World War II. When the taxes, and there was a stop on everything, and so people started to give benefits outside of the tax thing, and mm-hmm. it's grown ever since then. So that's we'd have to go back to redo too.
I don't know how relevant this question is, but the federal government has a pension system, and it's not in trouble. Mm-hmm. And it would seem to me that the structure and incentives are very educational for this entire problem. Can you comment on that at all?
Yeah. Okay. So. Not specifically about the federal pensions, but the federal government, the relationship of public sector unions to the government is very different in the federal government than in the state and local level. And so that's something to keep in mind. This is a good point that we should look into more. What exactly is going on at the level of the federal government? Are there lessons here for state and local governments? But public sector unions are actually much less influential, public sector employees of the federal government. They can't bargain over wages. They can't bargain over much of anything. And at the state and local level, the laws are much more flexible in terms of defining what's bargainable and what public sector unions can actually help to shape. So point taken, we should do that. And it's important to keep in mind that the legal framework is very different.
As I understand it, the local entities can go bankrupt. Mm-hmm. The state can't, because it's supposedly a sovereign. Mm-hmm. We found out but California cannot print money, has no currency, and can't borrow money. And I would answer the man right there about the federal government. They have no problem with the pensions, but of course we're running trillion-dollar deficits each year. They don't have problems with anything as long as they're printing money. California can't do that. So Greece used to be a true sovereign. That is, they had a currency, as did Spain. And well, now they're in the EU, in the euro currency. They're really not sovereigns anymore. They're like states. And so in Greece, all of these pensions were promised, but they're not going to be paid. It's totally obvious they're not being paid. The same in Argentina, the same in any other country that literally their currency collapses. So in California, when the Madoff moment or the Greek moment comes, will the federal government bail us out? That's the real question. Otherwise, I don't believe the pensions will be paid. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's where we are.
So I don't know. I don't know if the federal government would bail us out. I think it would establish a very dangerous precedent, since the whole problem of irresponsibility, I think, would even be worsened if there were an option, or if people knew, politicians knew, that if they got in trouble, the federal government would bail it out. So it creates, that would, in fact, I think, worsen the incentives to make responsible decisions. But I don't know. We're going into unprecedented territory here, so only time will tell.
CalPERS is the largest pension system in the United States. Did your study look at the impact of CalPERS on this pension situation?
The impact of CalPERS on the pension situation?
Yeah, so what their actions. They take votes on pension issues.
Yeah. So there have been a few studies of CalPERS specifically, because it is the biggest pension fund. And really, if you look at the blow-by-blow actions in CalPERS over the last 20, 30 years, you realize that the irresponsibility that I've described here is only scratching the surface. There are all sorts of things that are troublesome. And Steve Malanga has done an article on CalPERS and the board and all of the decisions it's made. And there are players here that I haven't even mentioned in order to keep it simple. This is very complicated. But then you think about who's on the board. Are they financial experts? There was a proposal to make sure that there were members on the board, that a sufficient number of financial experts to make responsible decisions, but that was defeated, you know. So once you start to look at these individual cases, it makes it clear that there's actually much more going on here than I've led on to. And it's even more troubling than the situation the picture I've painted here.
On that optimistic note?
Yeah.
I'm sorry, we've run out of time. I'm sure Sarah can answer a few more questions afterwards, but because of the recording, we'll have to bring this to an end. So I want to thank Sarah for a great presentation. So ends another event at the Commonwealth Club in its 111th year of enlightened discussion. Thank you very much for coming.